And time for choke points. The state is finally going to pay some attention to one of the biggest choke points in the region. This involves widening I-5 through downtown Seattle, which I didn't know there was any room for. But it will come with a cost for people who drive I-90 and use those downtown CD lanes. Oh, let me guess. They're going to convert those over to extra mainline lanes?
Yeah, no.
No?
No. Here, just you got to follow me on this one.
Okay.
There's just, as you've driven...
Lead me through
it. Okay, northbound I-5, by far, one of the worst congestion spots in the state. We routinely backs up 4 miles before the West Seattle Bridge to the convention center. Variety of reasons, of course. Lots of lane changing, lots of weaving to the downtown exits, the CD lanes, I-90, the express lanes. And it certainly doesn't help that one lane of I-5 northbound goes away at Seneca Street. It is an exit-only lane, which causes another round of lane changing. And if you've noticed, driving that direction, there's just a little bit of room there on the left-hand side of the road after Seneca ends. The state is planning to use that to convert into a new lane.
You go from 3 lanes to 2 lanes to 3 lanes, and you know the traffic pinches down. And so things really slow down, and we can see delays in that.
So the Washington Department of Transportation's Tom Pierce says the state is finally going to make the change. It is going to use that room between the Seneca off-ramp and the on-ramp from University to add a lane, basically connecting those two dots.
We're going to go in and fill in that little 1,500-foot gap. So Seneca will become a regular off-ramp, but there will also be a through lane there. So then we end up with 3 through lanes the entire way on northbound I-5 from I-90 to the convention center.
So this should finally add just a little bit of extra room, cut down on a little weaving and merging. Construction on this project is set to begin next month. Pierce says it'll take 2 full summer seasons to finish. The goal is to have this open in the fall of 2022.
We expect that when this section becomes 3 lanes all the way through, that just reduces merges, lane changes, and things. That's going to help smooth out the flow of traffic.
Now, of course, I mentioned, and let's be honest, they're really squeezing this baby
yes.
in there. So,
are they going to narrow all the lanes to make that work?
Well, I'm still waiting to get info on exactly what they're doing with the lane sizes. Right now, I believe they're going to stay standard at 12 feet because they're going to do some work in there.
Yeah.
But remember at the top, you read something about the cost to I-90
yes.
and CD lane drivers. Well, WashDOT has another piece of this downtown I-5 puzzle to place, and it's not going to likely make people happy. Pierce says the state will be installing ramp meters at the end of the CD lanes
uh-huh.
to control the flow onto I-5.
You predicted this a year ago.
I've been talking about this for a while. Yeah, and so I've been trying to tell people this is coming.
Uh-huh.
So that means eastbound I-90 drivers, Dave, when you finally come back to the office, when this is all said and done, hopefully before fall of 2022, you'll be going on I-90 westbound, and you're going to pop onto I-5 northbound, and you might be stopped at a red light.
This project is going to add 2 lanes that are going to come onto I-5, but we're going to have ramp meters so that it actually, the 2 lanes do funnel down to 1.
Again, it'll be based on volume, Dave. It's
okay.
One of those ones where it's not, you know, kind of like what we see on Mercer now, getting onto I-5. They've added ramp meters there, and they're on or off depending on the
right.
time of day and the time of volume. So in the morning, maybe not necessarily at 4 a.m., but it's something that's going to be coming. So it's not going to be a freeway from westbound 90 over to I-5. Now, I know that's not going to make a lot of people happy, but Pierce says they're also adding a northbound I-5 on-ramp at Cherry Street, which right now is also just a free onto the freeway. That's also probably not going to be making people happy, but it's also about controlling flow.
Once these ramp meters are in place, then that's really going to reduce the urge of drivers to speed up, try and get ahead of somebody, because you're really not going to gain much. You might gain a car length, and really, is it really worth racing around to gain 1 car length?
Final piece of this, an exit-only lane to Olive Way on the right-hand side. So this is going to be a big change for drivers, especially those of you that use the CD lanes in westbound I-90, but the goal is to clear out this daily choke point on I-5 and make it a much better drive.
All right. I look forward to it.
We warned you this was coming. In fact,
yes,
this was supposed to happen a year ago, but the bids came in way too high. And so they said, no, we're starting over. And that's why we're delayed. But it's happening now.
Every month, we chat with Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner about the local housing market. We're going to hear his analysis of the March numbers later this morning. But I also wanted to ask him about something that I get asked a lot by listeners about, and that is the national debt.
Naturally, there's a lot of people, and understandably so, concerned about where not just the national debt is going, but if you think about the budget deficit, we got a budget deficit now at a level we haven't seen since the end of the Second World War.
Yeah.
So it is a massive, massive number. It is going to continue to go up, certainly if the new administration gets its infrastructure plan through. But this is a problem which I don't think is going to get solved, quite frankly, in our generation. This is an issue we're leaving for our children and ultimately our grandchildren to address. Because the only way you can address issues, certainly in terms of debt, be doing two things. Government has to slow down spending money, or it has to raise taxes. I think that those are the only two ways we can try and figure it out. And I think that that's going to be a very tough sell for a lot of people.
Right. So what are the consequences? If you look at the numbers, you'll see that for example, the U.S. gross domestic product, total worth of all goods and services, $21.6 trillion. National debt, $28.1 trillion.
Yep.
So I guess officially we're sort of bankrupt, but since we can print money, that's okay. And yet, you know, you worry that we're going to get back to those days of rampant inflation where interest rates, your mortgage rate was 15%.
Right. Well, I mean, a couple of things. One of which is, yes, debt levels have gone up. However, interest rates haven't. And so the government can take advantage of what have been, up until recently, historically low interest rates. But without a doubt, a lot of people, I mean, Larry Summers, who ex-Treasury Secretary, is doing the rounds on radio and television now, saying that he expects to see this, as you mentioned, rampant 70s-style inflation. I don't see it, and a lot of my colleagues don't either. We are in a very different world now than we were then. Back in the 70s, you had an administration under Nixon that wanted to keep interest rates low because they thought it was a good thing to do. They also fixed price costs of food, for example. But more importantly, you have to look at unionization. So one in three workers in America was a member of a union back in the 70s. What is it now? It's around 10%. Hmm. So it's a very different situation.
So what's helping us is that workers can't force higher wages, is what you're saying.
That's exactly right. And in concert with the fact of, back then we stopped imports because, again, the administration back in the day wanted us to buy domestically, which is very expensive. Now we now import a lot of goods. The dollar is strengthening, which is what we've certainly seen the last several months, means that people are very keen to import their goods to this country. And again, when you start seeing that, that tends to act as almost deflationary rather than inflationary. So we, at the same time, I mentioned the dollar strengthening, that had been happening. But if we start seeing it weaken, again, that plays against inflation and more into deflation.
The Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. Kindness shown to a Vancouver, Washington woman has led to a new job at a place that helped her family in a trying time. With this guest Dose of Kindness appearance, here's Cairo Radio's Diane Duthweiler.
Lauren Reagan lost her son Declan when he was 6 years old.
When he was ready to go, he left us. But he also had impacted and brought so many people into my life.
Declan's leukemia diagnosis meant more than a year of treatments that included frequent blood and platelet transfusions.
See a kid that has a very low hemoglobin count, and then you give them a fresh bag of blood, it is like sugar times 100. I am so internally grateful for all the donors over those years, because not once sitting in the hospital being like, he's not acting right, he needs a blood transfusion. I never thought it wasn't going to be there. This community here in the Pacific Northwest gave me 5 months with my son that ultimately I could have not. It could have been very quick. It could have been a week or 2 weeks. He loved blood drives. He would host them on his off time, like when he wasn't in the hospital. We call them like his blood parties. I have pictures of him holding adults' hands as they're like looking away. And he's just sitting there and be like, this is nothing. The community that came out for his memorial service included blood work staff. So that's like 2.5 years ago. And now I'm onboarded and I'm an employee and I get to continue to share Declan's story.
6 months ago, Lauren joined the staff of Bloodworks Northwest as a business development rep. She's grateful for his special care there and other acts of kindness her son experienced because he lived those extra months.
With the resources given by Bloodworks Northwest, I was able to have that time, and he got to see that movie.
Declan loved dinosaurs, and when he was diagnosed with possibly only weeks to live, one of Lauren's first thoughts was that Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom didn't come out for 6 more months. One of the movie's stars, Chris Pratt, who spent most of his childhood in Lake Stevens, sent Declan a message of encouragement.
I want to send my love and my thoughts and my prayers to the Reagan family. So sorry for what y'all are going through, but I just wanted you to know that I'm thinking about you. I hope that might put a smile on your face.
The producers knew about Declan. When they finished their movie, they flew a cut to the Northwest and rented a movie theater for a private screening for Declan and his twin.
We got to see it about 4 weeks before its world premiere. So I always joke that I got to see the movie before Chris Pratt even did. Because they told us, they're like, you are maybe like the 7th or 8th person that has seen it. It was like such a magical experience for my boys.
G. Scott getting ready to join Ursula at 9 o'clock here in Cairo Radio. And this is it. Carlos Dunlap, who's going to re-sign with the Seahawks, says he's gotten personal assurances that Russell Wilson's not going anywhere.
I thought we talked about this here on the show, y'all. I thought we just said that Russell would just went on a drive, a little ride real
yes,
quick.
Yes, you were right along.
No, it wasn't just me. Everybody was on that. We just knew he was just a little bit frustrated. You know, even though things was going right in the house, he came on back home, and now he's home, and he told Carlos, he says, hey, Carlos, tell everybody that I'm going to be coming back for sure, even though I'm already back in the house.
Why would he have Carlos be the messenger for that? Why can't he just put that on Instagram? Because he puts everything else on Instagram, as we know.
He
signed a contract in bed.
Russ, did you think him signing, letting everybody know that he's back in bed did you think that was a good idea?
I mean, part of me likes it because, you know, if you love somebody, why not show it off? We have enough awful things going on in the world. But I don't know. There was just a tone in his voice that was a little icky.
Well, I mean, whenever I do a contract, I like to do it from bed, too.
Yeah, my contract's up in a year. When I resign, y'all are in for a show.
Are you going to say, at the very end, are you going to say, go Cairo?
I'll have Chris say it. I'll have my husband say it.
Remind me to be on vacation that day.
What else going on? Y'all see what happened with Tiger Woods? What happened with him?
Yeah, he was going a little too fast, like 87 miles an hour. What's that?
I mean, when I saw his statement in the last few days, I received word from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department that their investigation regarding my traffic accident back on February 23rd in Los Angeles has been completed and closed. I'm so grateful to the Good Samaritan. Look, man, they said he was speeding. They said he was going 84 to 87 in a 45. And you mean to tell me y'all didn't take no blood?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
come on, man.
But they said he didn't appear to be intoxicated.
Come on. Well, I mean,
well,
he was
hurt. Because
he was unconscious.
I mean, how do you hit a tree and break your leg in a few places and appear?
So that's what you think it was, huh? You think it was just?
What it does is you leave to speculate, and I'm gonna tell you this: the fact that as soon as the investigation was complete, Tiger Woods comes out, and I want to thank the sheriff, and I want to thank those police officers that showed up to the scene, and I want to thank you. I know why you want to thank them, bro.
You're saying they covered something up.
I mean, he's got a past.
Why would they try to protect him, though? What does he have on the cops that would cause them to protect him?
I don't know.
You know what I'm saying? What's in it for them if they protect Tiger Woods? We all know his past. It wouldn't be a surprise if something came up.
Hey, what was in it for them to protect O.J. Simpson back in the day?
You're going to go all the way
there,
huh?
Nobody but him was hurt.
So are you guys saying that when people are celebrities and star statuses that they are never protected?
No, I'm not saying that. I just, what's in it for Tiger Woods?
Sure,
you know what I mean?
Here's the thing. I don't know. And by the way, I'm not going to speculate that that was happening. I just thought it was weird.
Yeah.
At 8-something in the morning, 80-something in a 45, and the comments are, he didn't appear to be. What?
Yeah.
Maybe he just got in a fight with his significant other and needed to blow off some steam with a little drive.
He was down at a golf tournament. He's at a golf tournament.
What kind of car was it?
One of their vehicles.
It was one of their vehicles.
Yeah, well, like I think it's something you would like an Oldsmobile or something. You
really?
Like Oldsmobiles.
I was, because the reason I'm asking is there are some of those cars that just beg you to take them screaming around the curb.
It was like an SUV or something. It wasn't.
No, exactly, Dave. You know, right? You know, you ain't speeding too much in a Buick. No. You know what I mean? Like, if there are some state troopers listening right now, y'all probably don't even pull over Buicks. You already know what they doing. Now, if you somebody
say this, it is a substance thing, I mean, we can have some fun here, but if it is a substance thing, I hope he gets the help he needs. And if anybody's listening who's also struggling, I want them to know that we might be laughing right now, but there is no shame in getting help. I mean, I know I'm kind of bringing it down right now, but I just worry about the message we're sending by having some fun with Tiger Woods when we do know he's got a history of substance abuse. So go get the help you need.
And G. Scott will join Ursula at 9 o'clock right here in Cairo. Thank you, G. Yes. Yep. Hannah Scott. On the issue of felons voting, they will automatically get their right to vote back the moment they leave prison under a bill signed by Governor Inslee. And Hannah's here with the update.
And that's right. That automatically, as soon as they're not in prison for a 24-hour period, so it's called total confinement, that's what this bill does. They can. It used to be that if they were on community custody, which is kind of like a parole or a probation, they would not be able to get their voting rights back. And there was other hoops they had to jump through until after that community custody was served out. That's no longer the case. The minute they're out of those walls for 24 hours, they can now automatically have those voting rights restored. They do have to re-register to vote, though, if they want to cast their ballot. And Democrats say this is long overdue.
It's about taking power away from certain communities, and most specifically communities of color. This is an equity issue.
The argument that there is any sort of correlation at all between the safety of our neighbors by restoring the right to vote, simply not true.
But Republicans disagreed.
Let them finish their sentence.
They haven't finished their full sentence being on community custody. They're just outside of the prison walls.
To automatically allow a felon to vote for or against the very people who make the laws that had he or she incarcerated seems quite unfair.
As you heard from one of those sound bites was Patty Cooter there saying this was an equity issue. This was a big, big, big desire for Democrats in that racial equity bucket that they're looking at. And it was sponsored, actually, this time around. Patty Cooter has sponsored it in the past and I believe did in the Senate for the companion bill. But the version that passed was House Bill 1078. That is from Tara Simmons. She is our freshman representative who was a felon. She did time and she spoke about how being able to vote and get back into society was something that helped her turn her life around. And that's why they want to push this through, because the belief is that it helps get people back into society and makes the community safer.
Well, that's significant. But the Republicans raised a question. In other words, they do not have to finish out their complete sentence to get the voting rights back.
Right. That's the community custody. If they're out and they're still under DOC supervision, which is what community custody is, that's what Republicans are saying is that's still, they haven't finished
that's
up their
sentence.
That's
still part of the sentence. I see.
Yeah, but the sentence that they're talking about under this bill is total confinement, which means you live in the prison all day, every day.
Right.
So as soon as you're not doing that, you get the rights back.
You get the right to vote. Now, were Republicans on board, though, with the overall concept of restoring your voting rights once you have done your time?
Some were, and it did have some Republican. In fact, it had a Republican co-sponsor, Jesse Young. Uh-huh. So there was definitely some Republican support, but there's a handful who definitely were against it. Some who've been crime victims themselves and who say that this really lacks anything as far as the victims go. You could have, you know, a murderer who was released eventually, who's out and is able to vote for the laws that, you know, that got him locked up in the first place, like you heard Jenny Graham there say at the end. So that was pretty much the pushback that I heard. But you heard from victim advocates in the original testimony of the hearing saying this was what they wanted. People who had been victims or worked with victims said that this is a way to help people get back on track and, again, make the community safer.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
A new lawsuit aims to allow insurance companies to continue to use your credit score to determine your insurance rates. With that story, here's Car Radio's Heather Bosch.
The American Property Casualty Insurance Association claims State Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler overstepped his authority when he passed an emergency order prohibiting insurance companies from using your credit score to set your rates.
Well, I'm frankly surprised.
Kreidler says it's his job to protect consumers. And though the association says credit rates have remained steady during the pandemic, Kreidler says for many, that won't last.
People that have been able to not have to make their mortgage payments and the like, that's still going to come back at some point and be a part of their financial record and work against them.
The lawsuit seeks to stop Kreidler's order from taking effect June 20th. Kreidler has long opposed the practice of using credit scores to set rates. He says the practice unfairly leads to minority and poor residents paying more, even if they have great driving records. And he bristled at the industry's assertion that many Washington residents will end up with higher insurance bills if credit isn't taken into account.
I can tell you right now, I've got a very good credit rating. I wind up paying significantly less for my car insurance because they're getting poor people to pay more, even if it's inappropriate. I don't need their subsidy.
The lawsuit seeks to stop Kreidler's order from taking effect June 20th.
In the weekly jobs report. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Let's take a look at the housing market with Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. I think we should dive right into the numbers here because in looking at the numbers for March, the number of homes on the market was down like 53% in King County, but prices are up. So where do we stand here?
I kind of feel sometimes like a broken record. The number of houses, as you said, are down. In fact, you combine single family and multifamily, as you mentioned, in King County, year over year, is down by 37%. But also, as you said, prices are up. The median price is what, up by over 14.5%. There's a couple of things in the data which I thought were interesting. And that is the fact that the number of new listings, although down in some markets, both year over year, as well as month over month, significantly higher. Mm. So what does that mean? Well, that means is that if a home is coming on the market, it's naturally selling very, very quickly. Days on market, obviously, is very low. And when you really kind of look deeper as to the reason why, well, we saw almost a 20 basis point, 0.2% increase in mortgage rates last month. I think that's got some more buyers off the fence. At the same time, belief in housing is there. Prices are up. And we still have, as you mentioned, ultimately a woefully inadequate number of homes for sale.
Okay, so let's talk about the big issue surrounding housing. Of course, that is making it affordable for everyone. We now have a new housing anti-homelessness coalition. I don't know if they have an official name or not, between business and many of the nonprofit groups. But one of the things that I'm still hearing complaints about is, okay, you can go ahead and do your tiny homes and your shelters and all the rest. But at some point, you just got to build more really cheap housing. And we don't seem to be able to do that. Now, as an economist who's working for a real estate company, do you ever see that changing?
I wish I could say yes. First issue we have ultimately is lack of land. We're not making any more of it. We're topographically constrained, a lot of water, a lot of mountains. And given that fact, and the fact that the limitations are on amount of developable land, that pushes the land prices up for what we do have. So land is expensive. Labor is expensive. Material costs, lumber costs are up by 170% over the last several months, and regulatory fees. So when you take all these things into account, it makes it ultimately very, very expensive to build. And because the fact that builders are more cautious now than they were before, let's say, the housing bubble burst, when they were highly leveraged, well, now they've got to put some of their own money in. They're being cautious as well. So if there is an issue around the housing market, as you know, and I've mentioned it several times over the years, it is affordability, because at what point are businesses going to say it's just too expensive for me to open up my company here, given what I would have to pay people so that they can afford to live?
Yeah.
And as that happens, well, other markets like Spokane, like Boise, and I would even argue Las Vegas can be markets which could at some point take advantage of that, because their houses, well, I'll give you an idea. You can pick up a brand new, never lived in single family home in any of those three markets for about $350,000. Good luck finding a shoebox in Seattle for that.
Okay, so what about changing some of the regulations or changing some of the zoning, which we've also discussed? There are still a lot of close-in neighborhoods zoned for single-family houses.
Well, again, we're not making any more land. Therefore, you do have to look at whether zoning is still appropriate. And I'm afraid this is a very kind of messy subject as people are very much on one side of the fence or the other. I think all of us here in Seattle want to embrace housing that is affordable for everyone. But unfortunately, in many neighborhoods, they're saying, yes, we want it, but we don't want it here.
Yeah.
We want it somewhere else. And I've certainly mentioned that zoning, we need to look at it because we really haven't looked at it that closely since it was created here in Washington State back in, 1938?
Mm-hmm.
So it made sense then. Doesn't it make sense now? A lot of people get up in arms about it. They think that I'm advocating for the development of 50-story high-rises. I'm not. But I think that when you look at where single-family zone land is, why can we not start thinking about ways of taking that land and allowing duplexes or even triplexes?
Right. Yeah.
These things which will fit, you can get twice, three times as many number of houses on that one lot, and that will certainly help. But people are very, very vocal that, and a lot of people just don't want it because I really don't think a lot of people understand the fact that we talk about density. It can be done very sympathetically to the existing neighborhood.
And it doesn't have to be just in Seattle either, because as has been pointed out, a lot of people who are pitching tents in Seattle don't come from there. They come from some of the surrounding Puget Sound neighborhoods. But, you're not going to see Bellevue tolerate the tents. You're not going to see Mercer Island tolerate the tents. And the last time they talked about Mercer Island, affordable housing on Mercer Island, they were talking like, I think it was $710,000 condos. So, I mean, do you think that some of these suburban communities will simply have to be required to take care of their own homelessness problems?
Well, I mean, as you said, I think most people, certainly if they are in that situation, as sad as it is, in respect to homelessness, they're going to want to be close to the amenities that they need. And those, obviously, for the better part, do tend to be here in Seattle. Do other markets and other neighborhoods and other cities, certainly they have a smaller issue, but they certainly have an issue. I mean, not just Mercer Island, although I doubt it, but Bellevue, but even up in Bellingham, for example.
Hmm.
Significant issues, our friends to the north.
By the way, there was a controversy that we discussed on the air about whether Fraser Crane could afford his Seattle condo. And I figured since you're a real estate economist, you could tell us what a condo like. You're familiar with the show, right?
Oh yeah, yes, I am.
Okay. So that condo with the, I think it's got like three bedrooms and three bathrooms, and of course that designer fireplace and the collectible furniture. But I mean, if you were to buy something like that with a view of the Space Needle now, what would you expect to pay?
Oh, good grief. It wouldn't surprise me if you'd be somewhere in the $3 to $5 million range.
$3 to $5 million See,
I'm not a real estate broker, so I'm just the numbers cruncher.
No, but I understand.
That certainly is what I was saying. And it's funny you mentioned condominiums, because that is something which people have been worried about through the pandemic, of a flight away from downtown. Yes, we saw that for a period of time. However, what we've seen is almost a resurgence in demand. So we've seen a softening of prices. There's no doubt about that. And even list prices are down fairly significantly. But some people are now still picking up those units. So the demise of the urban condo seems to have been somewhat overestimated. So I think it's certainly a good thing for those people looking to sell, and also possibly for people looking to buy as well, if we're going to see a continued price softening in that type of housing.
And you may have Fraser Crane as a neighbor.
Which would
be too bad.
It would be interesting.
Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. Matthew, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Take care, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.